This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Mondays on the show are when we usually spend time with North Carolinians with fascinating life stories whose work is having a positive impact on communities around the state. But we have something a little different for you today, a focus on impact of a bigger scale. The podcast Ways and Means highlights the work of local policy experts who think in unconventional ways about how to improve the world we live in. Each episode features research from faculty at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy, and it's hosted by journalist and WUNC alum Emily Hanford. Today, we'll bring you a few stories from that podcast, some told from places you're sure to recognize. And this first part of the show is a mystery of sorts. What really motivates people to get out of their cars and take the bus or ride a bike? A government innovation team in Durham, North Carolina, is dead set on finding out.
Many people think that government can't innovate, and that's certainly not true in local government in Durham. We are innovating all over the city.
Steve Shule is the mayor of Durham, North Carolina. He used to be a professor at Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy, and he loves to identify big problems and do something about them. He set up an in-house innovation team at City Hall that's done things like come up with a program that welcomes felons back to the community. But something the city wasn't sure how to tackle? The fact that 90% of people who work downtown commute to their jobs alone in their cars.
We're trying to reduce the number of people who drive downtown by 5%. If we can do that, we can stop building parking decks, and we really want to stop building parking decks.
Each new parking deck costs around $20 million. So the mayor was trying to solve a budget issue and an environmental one at the same time. Enter Joey Sherlock. Joey works at the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke. Yes, there really is a Center for Advanced Hindsight. Joey's expertise is behavioral science. He studies things like, what role do emotions play in our decisions? Joey was brought in to work with Steve and his innovation team that included people from City Hall and the Transportation Department. They were going to try to tackle the commuting issue with behavioral economics in mind. Here's Joey.
Yeah, so what we're trying to do here is we're trying to find ways in which we can design interventions that leverage an understanding of human psychology, an understanding of how humans think and how they behave. And importantly, we're looking to design interventions that are low or no cost and are trying to influence commuting decisions, but without costing a lot of money.
The team started with a huge brainstorming session. They got together in a room with snacks and markers and sticky notes, and pretty much every idea that popped into their heads about what could get people to stop driving, they wrote it down.
Oh, we've played with some really interesting ideas. So we've downright talked about paying people. What if we just gave people money to not drive?
They tossed out plain old-fashioned carpooling, too. And what they brainstormed about is, why do people not like to carpool? Maybe it's that quiet people don't want to be with people who like to talk a lot, or people who like to listen to talk radio don't want to listen to classical music. And that led to an idea.
You know, what is the best way we can match people to others who are like them and want to carpool, and what is the best way to design that journey? Is it that we set it and we make it so that people don't talk, or we make it so that, they listen to a shared radio show? So we were sort of playing with ideas like this, and in many ways you could call it, Tinder for carpooling. We were trying to create the perfect match.
The innovation team members decided to test some of their ideas on city workers in a 5-week study. One idea was a lottery with a twist. Here's Mayor Steve Shule again.
We had a weekly lottery. You could win $163 if you rode the bus.
Why 163? Because the researchers asked a bunch of people, imagine that if you rode the bus, you were entered into a lottery. How much would the prize need to be to get you to ride? The researchers took all the answers, removed the outliers, like if someone said I'd only do it for $1 million, and they averaged them all. And voila, $163 payout is the precise amount of money it would take to motivate people to get on the bus. Now, of course, your chances of actually winning that money are probably slim. But here's the thing. We don't think our chances are slim. We tend to overestimate our chances.
This is how lotteries work, right? We all think that we're going to be the winner. And so we wanted to take this very human insight and use it to try and encourage people to take the bus.
So idea number one was the ride the bus because you might win the lottery idea. Idea number two was based on another observation about why people don't take the bus. Because they don't know where the bus stops are. Seriously. If you're someone who's used to getting in your car every time you need to go somewhere, it's possible you have no clue there's a bus stop around the corner from you. And what about other alternatives to getting in your car? How about biking? Do you know where the bike lanes are? So researchers sent each participant in the study an email showing them exactly how they could get to work without a car. Each route was personalized.
If the individual lived in an area where there was a good bus route, they would receive a bus recommendation. If they lived somewhere where there was a nice bike lane, they would receive a bike recommendation. If they lived somewhere where they had neither, they would receive a carpooling recommendation.
These were not form letters. The headline on the email included your name, and it had a message just for you. For example, Fred, you could be getting more out of your drive to downtown Durham. And the email listed the benefits.
The benefits in terms of how much money they would save, in terms of how much time they would gain, and in terms of health, how much more healthy it was.
A message like this, with clear, usable, and personalized information, gets at something in behavioral economics called the intention behavior gap.
So where people are trying to lose weight, they intend to lose weight but struggle to follow through. And so this is just another one of those examples. And this personalized route acts as a means of making it easier for people to follow through on their existing intentions because we're reducing a knowledge gap.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I'm Chandra.
Come with me.
My office is here.
1,586 city workers participated in the study we've been telling you about. Chandrell Todd was one of them. We paid her a visit at work, and she told our producer that before she'd even gotten that personalized email, she'd switched to taking the bus, because she had to.
My transmission went out on my vehicle, and I said, I'm not going to stress. Why? So I had to catch the bus outside of my apartment complex, and then it took me downtown to the terminal. And then I had maybe a 5-minute brisk walk, and I was at City Hall, but I needed to exercise, so it was okay.
Then she got the email.
With the study, though, I found it really interesting because I was able to not only verify that that was the best route for me to take, it also gave me the routes that were possible if I wanted to walk to work and if I wanted to bike to work.
The bike route showed her how to get safely from her apartment through a busy area to a long open bike trail built over railroad tracks. So, did the personalized commuting routes and the bus lottery work? Did city workers in Durham drive their cars less during the 5-week study? Yes, in fact, they did. The city innovation team wanted to reduce driving by 5%, and they say they tripled that. The researchers did the math, and they found that the study participants altogether drove an estimated 28,492 fewer miles. And that reduced carbon emissions by 18 metric tons. That's equivalent to taking 4 cars off the road for an entire year. And remember, the study only lasted 5 weeks, and it was only about 1,500 people. Imagine what the impact could be if a government offered incentives not to drive all the time to everyone. Oh, and there was something else. The people who got out of their cars and took other forms of transportation were about 20% more likely to report being very or completely happy with their commute compared to the control group who stayed in their cars. The people in the study group reported exercising more and saving money too. Joey thinks there's a lot of promise in the idea that policymakers can use behavioral economics to nudge people toward good behavior. Now, maybe the thought of elected leaders using behavioral economics to nudge you into doing something kind of creeps you out. It doesn't bother Mayor Steve Shule.
Well, I don't think it's creepy. I mean, what I would say is I find it really interesting and really compelling research. And our behavior is conditioned in ways that we don't understand all the time. And that's one of the critical insights of behavioral economics. But I think it's fascinating. And I think it's really important to use it to our society's advantage instead of to our society's disadvantage.
Steve says it's really important, especially now, for local governments and for citizens to do what they can to reduce the carbon emissions that cause climate change.
Well, we have to do this locally now because with the U.S. government pulling out of the Paris Accords, we have to begin to take these things into our own hands at the state and local level. And In Durham, we have a very strong sustainability plan, and we're doing so many things now to try to support this sustainability work and to battle climate change. We have to do it at the local level.
You're listening to a special collaboration between The State of Things and the podcast Ways and Means from Duke University. Coming up, journalist Emily Hanford digs into new research about what it takes to turn climate change skeptics into climate change believers. This is The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Back now to a special Monday on the show. In partnership with the podcast Ways and Means, which highlights faculty research from Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Ways and Means is hosted by journalist Emily Hanford. And in this next story, Emily explores whether it's really possible to change your mind on something as big as climate science.
I said that climate change was nonsense. I didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it. And since I represented one of the reddest districts in the reddest state in the nation, that was the end of the inquiry. I admit that's pretty ignorant, but that's the way it was for my first 6 years in Congress.
This is Bob Inglis. He's a Republican who represented South Carolina's 4th congressional district in the mid-90s. According to the League of Conservation Voters, he had a terrible voting record on environmental issues.
Yeah, I was completely dismissive of climate change. It seemed to me that people like Al Gore wanted to regulate our very breath.
Bob served in Washington for 6 years, then he worked in private industry. In the early 2000s, he decided to run for Congress again. It was 2004. There was no doubt at this point that the climate was changing and that humans were the cause. The scientific evidence was clear. But climate change still wasn't a priority for Bob Inglis. Then something happened.
My son came to me, who's voting for the first time because he's just turned 18. So he said, Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. He's really saying, Dad, I love you, and you can be better than you were before. Be relevant to my future and my four sisters' futures.
Bob started to realize that his votes on climate didn't actually line up that well with many things he really cared about. He didn't suddenly make the environment a big thing in his campaign. He won the election and his son's vote without addressing climate change at all. But he kept thinking about what his son had said. Then he joined a congressional delegation to Antarctica, where he talked to researchers grappling with the melting of the polar ice. And he went on a trip to Australia, where he met a scientist named Scott Herron. Scott's a NOAA oceanographer. He's also a committed Christian, just like Bob Inglis is a committed Christian. And when Scott Herron started talking about climate change, he spoke about it in language Bob could relate to.
Scott was preaching the gospel. I could see it in his eyes. I could hear it in his voice.
Scott told Bob about the Great Barrier Reef. It's an awesome thing, the largest structure on Earth made by living organisms. And it's being destroyed by rising ocean temperatures. Scott took Bob out to the reef.
As he would go down and show me things, and we'd come to the surface, and he'd be all excited about the incredible things that were there that he was showing me. And so I knew we shared a worldview. I could see that he was worshiping God. Later, we had a chance to talk, and he told me about conservation changes that he's making in his life in order to love God and love people. And I got right inspired. I wanted to be like Scott, loving God and loving people.
Bob had found a kindred spirit in a climate scientist. And pretty soon, Bob Inglis, the Republican congressman from one of the reddest districts in one of the reddest states in the nation, was saying things like,
listen, I was just wrong before. Climate change is real, and we can do something about it. And let's get going.
There's a big difference between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to beliefs about climate change.
In a nutshell, you see about a 40 percentage point gap between people who identify as Democrats and people who identify as Republicans in their concern about this problem.
This is Megan Mullen. Megan's an associate professor of environmental politics at the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University. She studies public opinion about climate change in the United States. She says there wasn't always a partisan divide on support for policies to protect the environment.
People start pollution. People can stop it.
Well, give a hoot. Don't pollute.
In the city or in the woods, help keep America looking good.
Back in the 1970s and early 1980s, there was essentially no difference between Democrats and Republicans in their support for spending on the environment. There was less difference in support for spending on the environment than for any other issue. There was essentially no partisan gap.
But things began to change as the conversation turned from protecting the environment to dealing with the threats posed by climate change in particular.
Early on, when the problem, you know, emerged in the public sphere, there were Republican leaders, President George Bush the first.
We all know that human activities are changing the atmosphere in unexpected and in unprecedented ways.
Later, even George W. Bush on the campaign trail, who said that the national government, the federal government, really needs to tackle this problem. But over time, fewer and fewer Republicans were saying that, and more Republicans were not only discounting the severity of the problem, but bringing into question whether this really even exists.
Voting yes on things like cleaning up rivers and protecting wildlife was one thing. Dealing with the reality of climate change was another. It involves difficult economic choices, reckoning with the impact of powerful interests, such as the coal and oil industries. Megan says polls show that as more Republicans question climate change, more Democrats became convinced about the urgency of the problem.
In the past few years, you actually see in the overall U.S. population growing levels of belief, growing levels of concern, but the movement is primarily among Democrats and to some extent independents, and you still see people who identify as Republicans resistant to the idea that humans cause climate change and not expressing high levels of concern about this problem.
Right now, what we have is a big gulf, a huge difference of opinion that falls squarely along partisan lines. Whether you believe in climate change seems to have become a matter of partisan principle. Is there a way to get past this? Megan Mullen thinks there is. She says, when trying to bridge partisan divides, many experts have focused for a long time on reframing the debate. The idea is, it's the language we use to describe things that drives us apart. If we could just learn to speak each other's language, we could come to some kind of agreement. But Megan Mullen thinks with climate change, there may be better strategies.
It's not simply craft a message, right, that overcomes the partisan divide. But are there ways that we can tap parts of people's identities, parts of people's predispositions, and get them to think about climate change in a different way than what we're trained to do in the political sphere? Can we evoke something else in people that will help overcome that divide?
This is where Emily Petcher-Diamond comes in. As a part of her PhD program in environmental policy at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke, Emily studied the impact our personal identities have on how we think about climate change. We all have many identities. There's our gender, our race, ethnicity, religion, social class, our age, where we live. But even as we have these different identities inside us, research shows it's our partisan identity that is the boss when it comes to how we think about climate change.
So your partisan identity, whether or not you identify as a Republican or a Democrat or a liberal or conservative, is one of the biggest drivers of how you feel about climate change.
Think about our different identities as different sets of glasses. When we talk about climate change, we're usually wearing our Republican or Democrat glasses. That's because climate change usually comes up in the context of politics. Which solution should we choose? Republicans want this, Democrats want that. And because we tend to be wearing our Republican or Democrat glasses when we think about climate change, our partisan identity is salient or top of mind. So our opinions about climate change tend to run along party lines. For example, take this hypothetical. A guy named Joe. He's a Republican. And because he's Republican,
in general, we would expect that more often than not, he would be skeptical of climate change, or at least skeptical of the policy responses that are required to fight climate change.
Now, let's imagine Joe is at a political rally, so he has his Republican glasses on. There are signs like, "Vote Republican," and "I may not be perfect, but at least I'm not a Democrat."
Who believes in global warming? Raise your hand. Wow. Not much, huh?
So Joe is listening to all of this. He's fitting in with his group. His Republican glasses are definitely on. Not only is Joe going along with his group, odds are that being at this rally, his anti-climate change views will become even stronger.
He's going to double down on his opposition against climate change policies.
But then the rally ends. Joe gets in his car. Let's say you're Joe. You drive home.
Now you're with your family and your identity as a parent has replaced your partisan identity in terms of which one is most top of mind, which one is salient. We might expect your attitudes and behaviors to be more reflective of your parental identity than your partisan identity in that context.
In other words, you've switched your Republican glasses for your parent glasses, kind of like Congressman Bob Inglis did when his son prodded him to clean up his act on the environment. He had his parent glasses on when he was talking to his son, and that made him think about his positions on the environment a little bit differently, as a dad instead of as a Republican. So Emily Petcher-Diamond was thinking about all of this, that people have different identities and our identities influence our feelings on climate change. And then she had an idea. She wondered, what if researchers created a situation where people put on their parent glasses before thinking about climate change? What would happen? Would Republicans see climate change differently? So she tried it. She recruited a group of people to take an online survey.
So they identified as either a Republican or a Democrat, but they also were a parent.
She divided the participants into groups. One group started with questions that were designed to make them put on their political glasses, to think about their partisan identities.
So it asked them a number of questions about what their partisan identity was, how important to them it was, etc. Really just designed to bring that identity top of mind.
Getting people to think about themselves in a certain way before you ask them something is called priming. So the first group was being primed to think of themselves as either a Republican or a Democrat.
Now, another treatment group instead got a series of questions that were designed to prime their parental identity, asking them if they were a parent, how many children they had, making them think about their role as a parent in society.
So one group has their parent glasses on. Another has their partisan glasses on. Next, everyone got the same message.
Specifically about the impact of climate change on future generations. So this was an excerpt from a report from UNICEF that looked at how devastating climate change will be for children.
In every crisis, children are the most vulnerable. Climate change is no exception. As increased droughts and flooding affect food production, children will face more hunger and malnutrition.
And then I wanted to see if priming their partisan identity compared to their parental identity would change their levels of climate change concern, their support for various climate change policies, and their willingness to undertake political behaviors in support of climate change policies. So one of the main things that I found in this study is that among Republican parents, when their parental identity was primed before they received this message, these individuals were actually more likely to
be concerned about climate change, more likely to undertake political behaviors in support of climate change policies.
They were up to 12% more likely. So more than 1 in 10 Republicans moved in a positive direction when it came to support for policies to reduce the effects of climate change. And 1 in 10 people changing their minds, that could make a difference between climate change policy stalling in Congress or getting passed. Emily thinks policymakers and advocates could learn from her results.
So it may not necessarily always lead to bipartisan support, but we're going to start to get the Democrats and Republicans feeling more like parents, for example, like a group of parents that feel similarly, as opposed to partisans who feel different.
Congressman Bob Inglis used to see climate change as a wild exaggeration by Democrats. Now he sees it as a threat to his kids and to future generations. In 2009, shortly after his epiphany at the Great Barrier Reef, Bob did something professionally risky. He introduced a bill in Congress to tax fossil fuels because they cause pollution that contributes to global warming. In an effort to appeal to his Republican colleagues, Bob wrote the bill so proceeds from the tax wouldn't go into government programs. The proceeds would go back to taxpayers through payroll tax cuts. His bill never got a hearing. And then Bob was voted out of office. He believes his sponsorship of that fossil fuels bill was a big part of why he lost. But he's not giving up on the idea that Republicans like him can change their minds about climate change. He founded an organization called RepublicEN.org. The EN stands for Energy and Enterprise. The group is affiliated with George Mason University, and they're part of a growing movement known as the Eco-Right. Bob is the public face of that movement. RepublicEN.org runs a news service about free market approaches to combating climate change. In 2018, the group completed a 14-city bus tour of the U.S., trying to get more Republicans to join the fight against climate change by supporting solutions that might not sound so Republican now, but were actually touted by big-name Republicans in the past.
Dr. Friedman is our guest, and we hope you'll join us.
We love to show a clip of Milton Friedman on the Phil Donahue Show in the 80s.
There is a case for doing something about pollution, but the way we've been going about it is the wrong way.
Who was asked by Phil Donahue, what do you do about pollution then, Dr. Friedman, if you don't want to regulate it?
Is there a case for the government to do something?
Yes, about? There is a case for the government to do something.
And
about
Friedman, you know, father of modern conservatism and one of Reagan's economics advisors, says, well, you tax it, of course. You tax pollution.
The best way to do it is to impose a tax on the amount of pollutants emitted by a car and make it in the self-interest of the car manufacturers and of the consumers to keep down the amount of pollution in that way.
Whether this approach will convince other Republicans remains to be seen. One thing that's pretty clear, though, Bob Inglis would do well to figure out how to get his audience to put on their parent glasses. After all, it's how he himself changed his mind on climate change. That 180 cost him his political career, but Bob says he doesn't have any regrets.
For me, chose that family group, and I know I chose the better, because just ask anybody whose first name has become former about just how much that crowd still loves you.
Emily Petcher-Diamond thinks there's a lesson in Bob's story and her research.
If we can begin to start talking about climate change and other highly polarizing policy issues in a way that gets people to think about how it affects them at a different level than their partisanship, then we have a greater likelihood of building more bipartisan agreement that will help us get the policy changes that we need.
That story comes from the Ways and Means podcast produced by Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Up next, we take a trip to Nepal and meet a professor who's hiked some of the biggest mountains on Earth. We'll also learn about how some researchers are using the power of rushing mountain streams to bring electricity to people who live way, way off the grid. That's all just ahead on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Today, we're bringing you stories from the Ways and Means podcast, hosted by journalist Emily Hanford. They all feature research from faculty at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. But you don't have to be a policy wonk to get into them. This last one is about something most of us use every single day, electricity. But there are almost a billion people worldwide who don't take this utility for granted. That's because they don't have it. That's almost a billion people with no refrigerator, no hot running water, no washing machine, no TV, no light at night for kids to study. Many don't even have a reliable way to cook that doesn't put people or the environment at risk. This is a common problem 7,800 miles away from North Carolina, in Nepal.
Nepal is a land of snow peaks and Sherpas, yaks and yetis, monasteries and mantras. Where else can you trek for weeks among the world's highest mountains?
80% of the country is mountainous. The big power grids that people in the developed world take for granted, they don't exist in most of Nepal.
Yeah, so the higher mountain areas are definitely much harder to reach. I'm pointing at this map of Nepal, which is showing electrification rates in 2011. So this area that's particularly has sort of low or zero electrification rates is this sort of higher mountain range.
This is Robin Meeks. She's a faculty member at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke, and she focuses on energy technology and policy in developing countries. She says because so much of Nepal is off the grid, people have turned to other ways to get power, like solar. But even getting solar power is a challenge. Solar panels are delivered by truck, and the roads aren't very good. Sometimes there are no roads at all.
You can imagine sort of if the roads aren't actually reaching certain villages, that people are actually carrying the solar panels on their backs up to the houses.
There's this other way that some people in the mountains are generating their own electricity. And they're taking advantage of the very thing that makes getting power so hard, the steep mountains, and the water that flows fast down those mountainsides. To generate electricity using water, people in the mountains don't have to build a big dam. They build a small, simple system instead, one that diverts some of the water rushing down the mountains into pipes. The water then flows through a turbine that's connected to a generator. The electricity is delivered by wires to homes and businesses nearby. The system is called a micro-hydro mini-grid.
Micro-hydro is literally you're using elevation and a stream and the flow of the stream to trap it and turn a turbine.
This is Duke Sanford School of Public Policy professor Subrendu Patanayak. He says micro-hydro mini-grids don't produce a whole lot of electricity, but it's enough to make a difference in many communities.
So you get lots of lights on, maybe small appliances, and that's about it.
Microhydro has been operating quietly in the mountain communities of Nepal for decades. But in policy conversations about getting electricity to more of the country, the discussion often turns to talk of how to expand the grid to bring big power to small places. But what if small power is the best option for these mountain communities? Not only might it be the most efficient way to power homes and businesses there, it might be the greenest way to do that. Hydro has a lot of benefits. Most importantly, it's renewable energy. That's why Subrendu has come to Nepal with a team of researchers. They're going to trek up into the Himalayas and investigate the decades-old micro-hydro mini-grid system, find out what's working and what's not, and see if it's time to invest more in this kind of power.
Hi, everyone. This is Subrendu Patnaik, a faculty member at the Sanford School of Public Policy. This recording could easily be labeled sleepless in Pokhara. After about four flights from Raleigh to Doha to Kathmandu and then Pokhara, we are finally here.
Subrendu Patanayak is in a hotel room in Pokhara, Nepal's second largest city. He's lying alone in the dark, recording an audio diary on his phone.
As I lie here, somewhat sleepless, jet-lagged, thinking about the place we're going tomorrow to see a micro-hydro mini-grid system. These are the kinds of systems that provide electricity to people who are off the grid. How are they coping? How are they trapping the river system at a micro scale? Lots of exciting stuff to see. With that, I'll stop and check in sometime later.
You're laughing.
The next morning, Subrendu and his team head out early.
On our way.
The snow-capped peaks of the Annapurna mountain range tower at the edge of the city. First, they travel along the flat city roads of Pokhara. But the paved roads soon turn into dirt roads. As the researchers drive higher into the mountains, the roads get narrower and narrower. Now the mountain is crowding in on the left, and on the right, the earth drops steeply away. They pass a team of pack horses. They're getting closer and closer to the clouds. They drive for hours. Eventually, the road runs out, and the researchers continue on foot.
It's about a 300-foot climb.
They climb huge hills, where the earth is naturally cut into what looks like the staircase of a giant. They walk carefully along tiny catwalks. To their left is the mountain ever rising. To their right, a sweeping view with mountains in every direction. They're getting close to a micro-hydro mini-grid.
We've climbed about, 800 feet. I'm climbing for the last 30 minutes. You can hear the purring of the engines as we pull close. And the path is a bit treacherous, so I should use my camera and feet carefully. And we're almost there.
The researchers come to a tiny one-story stone structure. This is the powerhouse for the microhydro system. The door has a simple sign in English that says generator room. An operator takes the team inside. The room is clean and mostly bare, with a concrete floor. There's a turbine in the middle of the room. It's pretty small, about waist high and 6 feet wide. It's enclosed, so you can't see the water flowing through. There's a big pipe between the wall and the machine. After looking carefully at the system setup and taking video and photographs, the researchers walk outside and around back. There are power poles and wires that go up a steep hill, carrying the electricity to the village above. In the village, Subrendu's research team meets entrepreneurs who use the electricity from the mini-grid to produce some of Nepal's famous handmade paper.
Okay. Before making a paper, we just dry it out for 1 day or 12 hours.
So you dry it here for a day?
Yeah, for a day.
For a day, and then where do you put?
Paper is called lotka. If anyone who's gone through any part of Nepal, and you will see that they will tell you handmade paper in Nepal. And it looks nice. It's very attractive. But it all comes from a reed that just grows in the countryside.
And then after that,
we just put in the boiler.
Boiler. What does boiler do? It's a hot water. You clean from there. You put it here. You mix water here.
Without electricity, you would sit there taking much longer to pound it, grind it, make it into a pulp, and then strain it, and then the paper is dried and you get paper. With electricity or just a small engine that can do every one of those activities without quite as much effort.
In the village, the researchers also find a baker slicing bread that was freshly made in a commercial oven using electricity from the microhydro mini-grid. Later in the day, Subrendu sees another baker. She has a basket on her back held in place by a strap around her forehead. And in the basket, she is carrying 50 loaves of bread. 50.
And I knew that every restaurant would have bread for their customers in the morning because this woman was supplying that. She had bread that she could bake and make because of electricity. So her livelihood and the whole region was prospering because of microhydro. That was a magical moment for me to see that.
It isn't all perfect, though. As the research team travels to other villages, they see some of the challenges of microhydro. Often, the systems don't provide enough power to meet demand. One business owner has had access to electricity for 22 years through a microhydro system, but...
So they don't have sufficient energy, so they find difficulties in operating the motors over there. They have some motor there.
Microhydro has been in use in Nepal since the 1960s and 70s. In 1996, the government teamed up with groups like the UN Development Program and the World Bank to build 1,000 mini-grids, with the idea that they would be a short-term energy solution for Nepal's mountain communities. It was understood that mini-grids wouldn't provide all of a community's electricity needs, but it was a way to get by until the grid reached these remote places. 20 years later, the grid still hasn't made it to many of these mountain communities. The initial funders of the mini-grids are gone, and many communities are struggling to maintain the systems. Approximately a third of Nepal's microhydro mini-grids have fallen into disrepair or flat out don't work anymore, according to Robin Meeks. She's the Sanford School faculty member we met at the beginning of the podcast. She says sometimes the problem is mechanical, like trouble getting replacement parts or having the funds to pay for regular maintenance. Sometimes the problem is keeping the skilled workers who operate the powerhouses, because once workers are trained, they tend to get hired away, even to other countries. But the biggest challenge the researchers observed on their trek through the Himalayas was not with labor or maintenance. It was trouble running the business side of the operation. Here's Subrendu again.
It's people not getting along with each other and setting up these systems and collecting money and trusting each other and fixing things and appointing someone to look after it. And it's not so much a technological thing, although, you know, it is an engineering marvel if you listen to the whirring of those engines and all that pipeline. There is certainly engineering involved. But I think what makes them succeed or fail is the human dimensions to that.
After seeing so many microhydro mini-grids firsthand, even with the challenges, Subrendu Padunayak still believes that microhydro shows promise. So does Robin Meeks. In fact, they think the technology could actually be expanded to become an even bigger part of the effort to provide sustainable energy to Nepal. This trip was just the beginning. Both researchers plan to continue their work in Nepal to try and figure out how to avoid the problems that have plagued some of Nepal's microhydro sites. They say what's likely needed is reinvestment. The funds could come from a variety of places, the government, nonprofits, NGOs. This money could be used to train people on the business skills needed to run an enterprise like a microhydro mini-grid. Robin and Subrendu know that others might argue this is a waste of money. Better to figure out a way to bring the more reliable grid to the mountains of Nepal. Many policymakers and experts argue that microhydro is simply too small.
Right, so the question here is small beautiful? In economics, you would learn that small systems have a fatal flaw and that there are economies of scale when you go big.
But to that argument, Subrendu points to a book that was written in the 1970s called Small is Beautiful, A Study of Economics as If People Mattered. It was written by the economist E.F. Schumacher.
E.F. Schumacher had sort of suggested that everything doesn't have to be on a large scale.
Schumacher was a fan of small, appropriate technology. Subrendu argues that if microhydro is supported properly, it could become more than simply what it was originally created to be, a stopgap method of delivering energy until the big grid comes along. He says microhydro might be exactly the kind of small, appropriate technology that Schumacher was talking about.
What we saw was a clean source of power. This is hydro. This is green. This is not dirty. This is the best kind of power that you can. The fact that it's still small scale and micro and not the main source is a puzzle. Is small not beautiful? Why couldn't more and more communities, especially in countries like Nepal, that are ready made for hydropower because of the terrain, the fast-flowing rivers, why is this not the main form of electricity in that part of the world?
Robin Meeks agrees. She says the grid is expanding across Nepal. Slowly, but it is expanding. She hopes that policymakers in the region will actually consider ways to smartly design the grid to be able to someday include small systems like microhydro mini-grids.
I think that different technologies are appropriate for different places. I think The idea that the grid is going to expand or go to every place throughout the world is not realistic in any time in the near future. So I think putting serious thought into which alternatives are appropriate and where and when, and then also thinking about, well, how do we make those technologies ready if the grid does expand, and then sort of having that forethought and planning for the future ahead is also very important.
If microhydro becomes more successful in the Himalayas, the lessons learned there could have a big impact, not only in Nepal, but in other places that lack reliable electricity and also have fast-flowing rivers and streams.
I think we are starting in Nepal because there are some successes, but our goal is to try to understand this for the bigger global story. There's other countries that also have mountains in Africa and in Latin America, the Andean Mountains and the Atlas Mountains, where the same system in theory could work. You need fast-flowing streams and pockets of people who are outside of the main grid who could benefit from this. So it's not just a question about Nepal, it's a global story. Yeah.
Our thanks to the Ways and Means podcast from Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy. You can find full episodes of the podcast at waysandmeansshow.org. And you'll hear more of the show right here next Monday. You can find out more about the state of things, sign up for our newsletter, and get a daily preview of our lineup all at stateofthings.org. That's the State of Things for today on North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.